Thank you.
I got a quick outside.
All right, but I'll be back.
Don't miss any votes now.
What's that? I'll miss some
votes. Any votes.
Hi, guys.
Okay, well, we're going to go ahead and start. Yes, good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. We're going to go ahead and get started. We got a pretty full agenda today, so we're going to stay focused on the task at hand. We will make a note when a full quorum arrives before we can take any formal action on bills. But we've got a couple of bills here on behalf of the Bar Association that Senator Newman is carrying. So why don't we just we should welcome Senator Newman back to the Judiciary Committee, too. Senator Newman is replacing Senator Ortman on the committee. So good to work with you on the committee again here, too, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So we're going to bring before Senate File 2003. Senator Newman, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a bill that originates from the Bar Association and involves real estate ownership. It's got some language in there clarifying language regarding spouses. It also has language in it, which, Mr. Chairman, is a frankly an estate planning tool for folks often when the primary asset they have is, for instance, their homestead, and allows for a deed to be prepared in advance of death, and then the transfer becomes effective upon death. I've got Mr. Kevin Dunleavy that is here with me this afternoon to explain the bill in more detail. And so at this point, Mr. Chairman, I would turn it over to Mr. Dunleavy.
All right, Mr. Dunleavy, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, it's a pleasure to be here. Actually, that's a pretty good summary. I don't know that I've got a lot to add to it. These are technical real estate bills. The first part of it, Section 1, is to deal with just making it gender neutral.
Mr. Dunleavy, I'm going to interrupt you. We have had a quorum check in, so just noting that for the record. You can go ahead.
Very good, sir. It's to take out gender-specific names and acknowledgments and for deed taxes and the designated transfers, which is a transfer that's exempt from deed tax because it's by a wholly owned entity with the individuals that own the entity.
Mr. Dunleavy, can you pull the mic closer to you as well?
Sorry about that. Then the second part of the bill deals with transfer on death deeds, which are a estate planning technique that when a person dies, then the property is transferred. And the first part of that bill clarifies the definitions of what's a grantor versus grantor owner versus an owner. There are a good example of that would be three brothers own a piece of property as joint tenants, and one of them grants a transfer on death deed for his interest. The other two don't join the deed, so they're owners, but the one that has the transfer on death deed for his interest is a grantor owner. It also expands and clarifies the definition of what's real property, what can be transferred with the transfer on death deed. There's no intent to make any substantive changes in what the law is. It's to clarify the law. So, for example, the priority of a transfer on death deed with any other types of lien, like a mortgage or a medical assistance lien, those types of things doesn't change. It's just to clarify the definitions of the grantor owner, and property interest that can be transferred. It also deals with revocation. You can't have a partial revocation. So if three people are on a grant on a transfer on death deed, if they're the grantors, the three brothers, this example again, and one of them wants to revoke it, that revokes the whole deed instead of partially revoking the deed. Then finally, the last part of the bill deals with redemptions from mortgage foreclosure sales. The statute hadn't been changed for a long time, and it referred to a one-year redemption period. And now there's a 60-day, 120-day, 5-week, 6-month, and 1-year redemption period. So there's actually 5 different redemption periods since this statute was passed. And this just changes it to say it's whatever the period of law that the law allows for redemption. That's all I have, unless there's questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dunleavy. Are there any questions, members of the committee, for Mr. Newman or Mr. Dunleavy? We could pepper Senator Newman with detailed questions.
Yeah. We should have at least one. After all, he's a new member. A new old member, right?
He's a returning member from...
a returning, that's a better, much better statement.
Previous iterations of this committee.
It's not necessary to pick on me, Senator.
All right.
If there are no, questions from the members, Mr. Chairman, I believe that this bill would go to the floor, and I would move that it be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
I'll make that motion.
All right. Well, Senator Newman's a member of the committee, make the motion.
Ooh.
Already exercising that power. Seeing no further questions, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails. Bill is passed. All right, Senator Newman, your next bill, Senate File 1979. That was a very good year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill 1979 is also a bill that has come to me from the Bar Association. I would indicate, Mr. Chairman and members, that we do have an A1 amendment that I would like to move at this point to get the bill in the form that I desire for purposes of proceeding.
Okay, members, the A1 amendment is in your packet. This is the first committee for this bill, so it's in the nature of an author's amendment, correct, Senator Newman?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
All right, Senator Newman moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails. Senator Newman.
Mr. Chairman, members, just by way of explanation, the A1 amendment is purely a technical change that has been requested by the Secretary of State's office, and the testifier will provide you with any further answers to that, should you desire. This is a bill that deals with business entities in the state of Minnesota and the conversion of business entities to and from domestic and foreign entities. I could be wrong, but I believe that we should make sure that by foreign we mean non-Minnesotan, not necessarily out of the country. And sometimes folks get a little confused on that, and there, perhaps, the testifier could also explain that in some detail. I do have Mr. Chairman, Professor John Matheson from the University of Minnesota Law School, seated immediately to my right, who is in a position to walk through the bill with you and answer any questions that you may have.
Let's do that. Professor Matheson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Senator. I appreciate the opportunity to be before the committee. Let me just give you a slight bit of background on how this bill came to be before the committee so you can best understand what it is. Every several years, a notice goes out among the members of the bar asking for those who are interested in suggesting changes to the Minnesota Business Corporation Act to start meeting. A hearty group of people respond to that notice. I know there were over 60 people on the email list getting notifications, and a group of about 20 people met on a regular basis every couple of weeks for about 6 months, basically to go over the Minnesota Business Corporation Act, to suggest technical amendments to the Minnesota Business Corporation Act, and also to try to update the act where it might be necessary to keep consistent with changes in other jurisdictions to make sure that our corporate statute is is readily useful to businesses as other jurisdictions. On that committee, in addition to myself, and I serve as a reporter for the Minnesota Business Corporation Act, we're representatives of the William Mitchell and Hamlin Law Schools, the Bert Black from the Secretary of State's office, and lawyers representing all sides of the spectrum of businesses and plaintiffs suing businesses. Everything that's presented to the committee today as part of this bill was agreed to by consensus of the committee. There were no dissenting votes, and we wouldn't bring that to the committee in that form. I will highlight for the committee a couple of the what I view as more significant provisions of the bill. This is primarily a technical amendments bill, which is why it doesn't read very very nicely from beginning to end.
Professor, you gave us the background on the group that you were working with. Is that affiliated with the State Bar Association as well, then?
When our group gets done putting together suggested changes, we take it to the State Bar Association and the Executive Committee of the Business Law Section, and it has to get approved by them as well before it comes to you.
Okay, so it's got sort of a double imprimatur.
Yes, it does.
Okay.
The provisions that might interest members of the committee, and particularly are designed to bring us up to date with some other jurisdictions and how actions take place, is, as Senator Newman mentioned, the ability to have companies engage in what we call cross-border conversions. You might start a business as a limited liability company in Minnesota, typical small business entity, and then at some point, hopefully, if you're successful, do an initial public offering. You may end up switching over to become a corporation at that point. It's fairly typical. You may end up incorporating or reincorporating effectively in Delaware at that point. That's not unusual as well. What we had in the statute previously was allowing LLCs to convert to corporations and corporations to convert to LLCs, but only Minnesota entities. This provision becomes consistent with those of many other states, including Delaware, that as long as the laws of the various states are involved, a Minnesota entity can convert to or from an entity of another state as long as both states' statutes are satisfied. It allows for much more flexibility for Minnesota businesses, and that's what we're talking about by this cross-border conversion opportunity. The second area that I mentioned is one where the technical amendment was presented, and that is in a number of jurisdictions, again, particularly Delaware, since it's a lead state in corporate matters, the Secretary of State's office serves to pre-clear certain documents that need to be filed. Documents generally are filed on a regular basis and get accepted or rejected by the Secretary of State, and there's no consternation except fixing those documents. In significant transactions such as mergers or major financings, the parties would like to know in advance if there's going to be a hiccup at the Secretary of State's office. So Delaware has, for a number of years, provided pre-clearance for certain documents. I'll mention that the Secretary of State has done that here on an informal basis in many circumstances over the years as well. What this bill does is make that process a more formal one. That is, that a document can be presented to the Secretary of State in advance of its actual filing for pre-review and clearance by the Secretary of State, so that when the time comes to close the transaction and there's multiple parties expecting something to happen on that day, that document will be effectively filed because there won't be any misgivings about the contents of the document. That's a very positive change for Minnesota businesses and for lawyers doing transactions with Minnesota businesses, and I'm happy we're making that change as well. I think the two final changes I'd mention specifically, and then be happy to answer questions, is in certain circumstances there is voting by certain classes of shareholders. If there's multiple ownership interests, common stock and preferred stock, for example, that's in our statute. All that we're providing by our amendment here is that if the articles provide, those groups that otherwise might vote separately would vote together if they're being affected the same way. So if we have a common stock and preferred stock and there's a new class of preferred stock being proposed that's superior to both those, the common and preferred would vote together on that change as opposed to typically voting separately. That won't be part of the statute or part of the operation of a corporation unless it's provided in the articles of incorporation of that corporation. So it has to appear in those articles before it's the applicant. But that's consistent with both the Model Business Corporation Act and the Delaware statute to provide for group voting when similarly situated classes of stock are affected the same way. The final provision is that I'd make mention to is more of a substantive one. There was a Minnesota Supreme Court case decided within the past year, U.S. Bank versus Cold Spring Granite, that I actually testified at the trial level at. You may know, we all know or have heard of circumstances where minority shareholders and corporations might be squeezed out by various actions, a merger of kinds. And typically, in those circumstances, while a minority shareholder might be eliminated, they typically have dissent and appraisal rights. They can say, I don't like what I'm getting in this deal. I'd like a court to determine what fair value for my shares is supposed to be. There is a provision in the Minnesota statute that allows a squeeze out of sorts to be undertaken by a reverse stock split and leaving fractional shares. And under the current statute, those fractional shares could be cashed out without any dissent appraisal rights at whatever amount the board, without fraud, determines to be fair value. The Minnesota Supreme Court upheld those provisions in a case recently. This committee reviewed that matter and said this is just a similar circumstance to a squeeze-out merger. Shareholders should have dissent and appraisal rights in this circumstance, too, even though the statute currently doesn't provide that remedy for them. And so this bill does give shareholders dissent and appraisal rights in a reverse stock split squeeze-out situation, which is very beneficial, obviously, for minority shareholders in those situations.
Okay.
There are, as you know, there are 38 sections of the proposed statute. I'm happy to walk through them section by section with the committee. I would say that, I can represent that the other provisions are almost without exception just purely technical amendments, trying to make sure we have the statute say what it's supposed to say and means to say.
Thank you, Professor. No, I'm not going to ask you to walk through all the technical corrections, but I do appreciate your highlighting the substantive changes for us as well. Any questions from members of the committee or thoughts on the bill that's before us? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. Is there anybody opposing any of this?
No one that has communicated to us. Senator Newman, okay. Do you know of anyone who's opposing this bill?
I am not aware of anyone that is opposing. Has been represented to me by the Bar Association that there is no one.
Good. I can tell you there are provisions that aren't in this bill where there was opposition and we couldn't work them out. And so we didn't bring
good.
Them.
Good. Thank you.
Maybe I should call the room. Anyone steeped in business law in the room that wishes to testify in connection with this bill, for or against? All right. Other questions by members of the committee? All right. Senator Newman, would like to make a motion?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that Senate file 1979 as amended be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
All right. I'm just going to add one more thought. I am pleased. I don't know much about business or corporate law, but I am generally in favor of shareholders' rights, and I'm pleased to see the change that you made to advance dissenting shareholders' ability to proceed in that matter. So.
How are you?
Senator Latz?
All right.
Is there still
Senator
discussion? Since
of course.
Just
sure, haven't voted
I
yet.
Just wanted to make sure, as the committee knows, and I'm sure the presenters know, I'm not steeped in business law either. So other than asking you to repeat everything that you said one more time, which I'm not going to do, I just want to make certain that I thought of something you implied, and that the Bar Association organized a group of people that would have the full range of interests as to who would be impacted by this law, and that the Bar made certain that an entire group of people that might see things differently than what is in this had a chance to improve this language so that what we have here is not later found to be an unreasonable action on the rights of some other people.
I believe that's how the committee operated, and that's how the bar operated and presented to the committee, yes, to this committee.
And then I have a Senator question Sherman. For you, Senator Latch. You said 1979 was a good year.
He did.
What was that?
He graduated.
I don't know, I was a sophomore you graduated, in high school.
It was a good year.
I had a good sophomore year. Oakland Valley High School still existed. All right, any further questions or comments? To Senator Newman's motion that Senate File 1979 be recommended to pass, be sent to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Newman, Professor Matheson. We will now officially also welcome Senator Champion to the committee, taking the seat of Senator Cohen. So we have two new members at their official first meetings today. So welcome.
Thank you.
All right, next item, Senator Franzen, Senate File 1648. Why don't you come on forward and you can have your first testifier. Your testifiers come up with you, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members.
Senator Franzen.
Senate File 1648 is a complete replacement, comprehensive replacement, and phased in of the limited liability company statute. And it uses the Uniform Limited Liability Company Act, and it's modified to address Minnesota-specific issues. What's the importance of this law or this change? Limited liability companies have become an entity of choice for new businesses. Annually, more LLCs are formed in Minnesota than corporations. The total number of Minnesota LLCs now exceed the total number of Minnesota corporations. Why is this change needed? In 1992, Minnesota took an unusual and innovative approach, borrowing from corporate rather than partnership law, to craft the new statute. The rationale at that time was that the learning curve for Minnesota lawyers, few of whom knew anything about partnership law at the time. Over the past 22 years, it has become clear that Minnesota's LLC law is isolated from the LLC laws in other states. Elsewhere, LLC statutes are based on the law of partnership and contracts. In cross-border deals, for example, involving interest from outside Minnesota, the Minnesota statute is useless. Lawyers from other states will not take time and incur the expense to learn sufficiently about this unusual statute so as to be able to competently counsel their clients. Minnesota lawyers rarely have enough understanding of partnership-based LLC statutes to completely counsel their clients without investing much time and expense, and therefore the most cross-border deals default to the Delaware LLC Act, which is problematic. In addition, Minnesota is cut off from case law developments in other states. Those developments have clarified many issues with this still relatively new form of business entity. Just to give a little background of how Senate File 1643 was developed, the Uniform Law Conference worked for 3 years between 2004 and 2006 to draft a revised LLC Act, replacing the original Uniform LLC Act, which was adopted in 1994. The drafting committee included experienced business lawyers and advisors from the American Bar Association, as well as commissioners from around the country, many of them experts in this area of law. Some of them were generalists, and some of them involved were heavily influenced by Minnesotans. Two of the commissioners were Minnesotans, Judge Harriet Lansing and Dean Harry Hainsworth. One of the two co-reporters was from William Mitchell College of Law, and the other one had been a professor from the William Mitchell College of Law as well and practiced law in Minneapolis. A committee of the Business Law Section of the Minnesota State Bar Association did a two-year study of the Uniform Act, made a few changes to accommodate particular Minnesota issues, and strongly supports Senate File 1648. In terms of any opposition, early during the study by the Bar Association Committee, the Attorney General's office expressed concerns about two issues, the nonprofit LLCs and the ability to hold bad actors personally liable for their misconduct. The Bar Association Committee has modified the act and resolved these concerns. Some lawyers who represent minority owners in closely held business expressed concerns that the Uniform Act would eliminate important protections for minority owners. And although the Bar Association Committee believes that this is just the opposite is true with this new act, the committee worked with the concerned lawyers to develop revised language acceptable both to the concerned lawyers and the committee. And the language will be added with the author's amendment today. So the major differences between the current law, which is Chapter 322B, and Senate File 1648, number one, the basic approach of the current law, Chapter 322B, establishes a detailed corporate-like governance structure which can be changed only by careful drafting. The Senate File 1648 differs almost entirely to the members' agreement, and the statute provides straightforward default rules for matters not covered by the agreement. Another change is the basic paradigm for allocating governance rights and economic rights among members. The current law, Chapter 322, has a golden rule. She, he, or it that has the gold makes the rules. The allocation is per capita, and decisions are based by majority vote. No allocation is placed for sweat equity, and the possibility for majoritarian oppression is built into the statute. Senate File 1648 involves the one person, one vote, and an equal share of the profits. Allocation is per capita, and if either party or profits are not to be equal, the members must so agree. And fundamentally important decisions require unanimous consent unless members have agreed otherwise. There is in your package, members, a structure of the act. It goes section by section, which recognizes the most noteworthy provisions. I'd be happy to go through it, or if you have questions in particular, I do have three testifiers that will also elaborate on the act and the major changes. And I'd like to turn it over first to Gene Henning, attorney at law with Gislason and Hunter, and MSBA member.
Thank you, Senator Franz. And before we do that, why don't we adopt your author's amendment? So, members, you have the amendment in your packet. It's from the Revisor's Office, Amendment A140772. Senator Franzen, would you just like to you gave us a summary of what the author's amendment does.
And, Mr. Chair, the other change that it does is, since this Senate file was introduced last session, it just adjusts the timing, the effective date of the bill as well.
Okay. Any questions on the author's amendment? Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Senator Franzen, the term oppressive on line 3, is that a new term that we're putting into law, or is that something that has been relied on in the past? And would that if so, is this a new definition?
Senator Franzen.
Mr. Chair,
or any of your testifiers,
I'll defer to my testifiers who were part of the discussion of where this amendment came from.
Okay. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Daniel S. Kleinberger. I'm a professor emeritus at William Mitchell College of Law. I was the reporter and one of the principal drafters for the Chapter 322B long ago when my now 29-year-old daughter was 4, I think. And I was one of the co-reporters and one of the principal drafters of the Uniform Act. Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, the term of art in the Minnesota statute has been unfairly prejudicial. The term of art in most jurisdictions is oppression. In almost every one of those jurisdictions, they define it as or including unfairly prejudicial. What we worked out with the attorneys who were concerned about this act was to define oppression so it includes that concept. So this is actually a more detailed guidance for the courts. Actually, when we were drafting the Uniform Act, I sought to get language like this put into the Uniform Act itself, and for some reason it wasn't put in, so we have it here. But there should, on this aspect, there should be no change in what constitutes oppressive or unfairly prejudicial.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer.
One other question. Was this definition approved by the Bar Association?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer.
Professor Kleinberger.
The Bar Association Committee, which did the study and which was charged with the responsibility for developing this, negotiated this, and then circulated among its all of its members, and they said yes.
All right, on this author's amendment, then, Senator Sharon will move the A140772 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Mr. Hennig, welcome to the committee. Nice to see you again.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Gene Hennig. I am a practicing lawyer in Minnesota, business lawyer. I might say it at the outset that Senator Franzen's testimony was flawless in every respect, but for one aspect, and that is I'm a member of the Gray Plant Moody Law Firm and not the Gisselson Firm. And you'll hear from Mr. Wade Wachholz, who's from that firm, in just a bit. Other than that, as I said, Senator Franzen's initial testimony was very accurate. It gave you a good high-level view of what this LLC Act is all about. My job here this afternoon is to continue in that vein and continue to give you a real high-level view of things. And then, as necessary, both Wade Wachholz and Professor Kleinberger can take you down to whatever level you want in terms of detail. So with that thought...
Don't tempt us, Mr. Hennig.
Excuse me?
Don't tempt us.
Well, I
what a tantalizing thought.
It's a challenge, I'm sure, for Professor Kleinberger.
Senator Limmer, we'll exercise restraint.
Let me go back to the beginning and emphasize that I'm really here in a couple of capacities. One, as a practicing lawyer, as I said, but also as one of Minnesota's uniform law commissioners. And they were the ones, that organization was the organization that had originally developed this statute some years ago. How best to get your arms around what this law is all about? Let me just raise with you and answer six or seven very basic questions that may be known to some of you, but perhaps not all of you. Starting with the fundamental question, just what is a limited liability company? Most of you probably already know that. But let me repeat for you what a limited liability company is and why it's important. A limited liability company is a form of business entity that has become very popular in the last two decades. It really is a business entity that is similar in some respects to a corporation in the sense that the owners of it can limit their liability. But beyond that, it departs from the corporate model and is more like a partnership in many respects. But the key feature of a limited liability company is, as its name suggests, an entity that allows folks to form a business and limit their liability. And so that's one of the important things that's there. It also has certain tax advantages that make it preferable in many instances to comparable provisions in our corporate statutes. So this limited liability company entity has become, as Senator Franzen said, a very important concept both here in Minnesota and elsewhere. Just to put it in perspective for you, within the past few years, approximately 30,000 new business limited liability companies are enacted every year in Minnesota, contrasted with only 6,000 corporations. So we're talking about a 5-to-1 difference in terms of frequency of use in recent years. Okay, that's question number one. What is a limited liability company? Number two, what does this new statute do that we're talking about this afternoon? What is the revised Uniform Limited Liability Company Act? Well, you have to recognize that every state now has some form of LLC statute, Minnesota included. Our statute was one of the first. It went back to 1992. We were some of the pioneers in getting this enacted. Every state, as I said, has some form of Limited Liability Company Act. About 10 states now, 9 to be precise, have adopted the Uniform Limited Liability Act. And so what we're trying to do with our legislation or proposed legislation here in Minnesota is to join those 9 states in enacting the revised Limited Liability Company Act. We believe it's a very useful act, and it's high time, we believe, for Minnesota to get on board with that. It would replace our old statute, which was enacted back in 1992, when this whole business model was very much in its infancy. All right. Question number three.
Mr. Hennig, I have a question in regard to that.
Yeah, go ahead.
If this passes, what impact will it have on existing LLCs? Will they have to make any changes, modify their articles or bylaws or anything like that?
Senator Letts, really nothing needs to be done, at least not immediately. Your existing LLC agreements, for example, remain in place. Your existing filings remain in place. If you have an operating agreement, that can stay in place. You can continue to form LLCs largely under the terms of the old act for a while. I think you have until 2018 before the substantive provisions of the new law would take effect as to existing LLCs. But even there, if you have an existing LLC agreement, and many LLCs have them, just like bylaws, you could continue to use what you have. Okay?
And could you choose to change over? If you're saying that, you know, the substantive provisions will take effect in 2018, but could you choose in immediately if you wish to change over those provisions?
I would refer to Professor Kleinberger on that. I believe that's the case.
Professor?
Mr. Chairman, there is a delayed effective date for everybody to allow the bar to reeducate itself a bit. Then there's a period of time when new LLCs are formed under the new act. Old LLCs may opt in if they wish. And then there comes finally a time where everybody comes under the act. But there are, as Gene said, a lot of transition provisions. The most, I think, notable is this. There are a lot of LLCs in Minnesota that have a board of governors structure because that's what the act offers people. The Uniform Act does not have that as a template. The Minnesota version of the Uniform Act has it, so that even those LLCs, when they come under this new law, it should be seamless.
Thank you.
Sure.
Mr. Hennig, go ahead.
Moving on to my third question, which has already largely been answered, and that is why is this act important to the state of Minnesota, and why should it be enacted? As has been mentioned, the form of limited that we're talking about, limited liability companies, has become the entity of choice for new businesses formed in Minnesota. So it's important that we have a modern statute. The limited liability structure has also replaced a lot of the old forms of business entity that some of you may be familiar with, such as subchapter S corporations. You may have heard of those before. This largely is replacing that. And it's really also largely replaced a lot of partnership law. Nowadays, when people form business entities, they gravitate towards limited liability company acts, limited liability companies, and for that reason, as well as the frequency of use, it's very important, I think, that we have a modern LLC statute, and that's what the revised LLC Act that we're considering here this afternoon is intended to do. What is there about, question number four, what is there about the existing statute that needs to be changed? I said before that since 1992 we have a Limited Liability Company Act in Minnesota, but that it's in need of revision. Well, why is that? As has been alluded to already, Minnesota and only one other state has adopted what we would call more of a corporate model of LLC statute. That's not true everywhere else. Everywhere else in this country, they have more of a partnership model. It's a more flexible model. It doesn't rely on such things as boards of governors and things like that. It's far looser. The new act also has much superior default rules, which is to say if you form a business entity and you don't have some kind of fancy operating agreement, the default rules are favorable to smaller business entities. I think it's very important, therefore, that especially if you're interested in the small business owner here in Minnesota, the type of business owner that doesn't have a lawyer, for example, and just shows up at the Secretary of State's office, informs the business. The default rules there are very favorable to smaller business entities. So there are many, many reasons why this new statute is preferable to what we have. The last thing I would say as well is one of the handicaps that we have these days is that when Minnesota lawyers are trying to form business entities, we're handicapped because we have such a out of sync statute. If, for example, it's a cross-border organization, it's very difficult to get other lawyers and businesses to do business with us as long as we've got our existing LLC statute. And another problem that arises as well is that oftentimes by default we have to run to Delaware and form entities under Delaware law. And that's no privilege for us. Delaware law is complicated. Delaware law is expensive. It costs us money to go there. It costs our clients and businesses money to go to do business in Delaware. And so, it's preferable to have our own state-of-the-art LLC statute. Question number six, you'll like this one in particular. What fiscal impact does this have on the state of Minnesota? I'm pleased to tell you virtually none. As a matter of fact, I would guess that, unless I'm mistaken, this bill should not cost the state anything. There might even be a positive fiscal impact. I'll hold it out as being a great one. The Secretary of State should realize some additional fee income from filings here in the state of Minnesota, which would be desirable. Lastly, last question, what is Minnesota's connection to this LLC statute? I think it's worth noting in conclusion, it's already been alluded to a little bit, Minnesota, more than any other state, has its fingerprints all over this revised limited liability company. Well, why is that? Well, first of all, we largely drafted it. I say that because Professor Kleinberger and his colleague, Professor Carter Bishop, had their fingerprints all over this thing. They largely wrote this statute. Beyond that, two other uniform law commissioners, Harry Hainsworth, whose name has been mentioned before, former dean at William Mitchell, and Judge Harriet Lansing, senior judge at the Minnesota Court of Appeals, both uniform law commissioners, both were on the drafting committee. So, as I said, our state, more than any other, has already gotten huge amount of impact on this statute. In conclusion, I might say it's just high time we ought to enact this thing because we largely wrote it and we ought to make it our own legally. So thank you very much. I'll turn the mic over to Senator Franzen and Wade Wachholz, I believe, is here as well.
Thank you. Mr. Wachholz, why don't you come on forward and you can offer your testimony. And when you and Mr. Hennig are done, we don't want any of your partners to get surprised or angry. Make sure you show up at the right office.
Yeah, I thought I had a new partner there for a second, and I would have welcomed that opportunity with open arms.
As long as you're formed under an LLC, you'll be fine, right? Mr. Wachholz.
My name is Wade Wachholz. I'm a partner with Gislason and Hunter. We're a law firm, just so you know, with offices in Golden Valley out here, but also in Mankato and New Ulm and Hutchinson, and we have an office in Des Moines, Iowa as well. I have been a member now of the Partnerships and LLC Committee of the Minnesota State Bar Association. It's a subset of the business law section for several years, and right now serve along with Bill Klein as the co-chair of the committee. Several years ago, and my point here and my offering, I guess, of testimony for this committee is to describe a little bit what the Bar Association's work was on this revised Uniform Limited Liability Company Act. And was alluded to earlier, the Act came out of the Uniform Law Commissioners, I think, in 2006 or early 2007. After that, this group, the committee that I'm a part of, formed a study committee in the mid 2008 to review this statute. We spent 2 years doing that. A group of about a dozen of us that were part of the study committee met every other month, so we, you know, we don't meet as often and as hard as you guys do here, but we did get together and do that. And we went through the statute, the proposed statute, section by section, line by line. Each of us took a part of the statute to study in detail and present it to the rest of the group. We kicked it around. We thought about all the ways that it would impact the way we practice law, the way we deal with business owners and businesses in Minnesota. took a very thorough look at it and worked at that until mid-2010. We thought collectively that it was a very good statute, that it would improve our interaction and our use of this type of business entity in Minnesota. But we did want to make sure that a couple of things got done to make it Minnesota-specific and so that it would work here. So we didn't take the statute off the shelf and just throw it wholesale into this. And a couple of those things have been alluded to already. I think the most important thing is that our current statute with the provisions regarding sort of a corporate structure with a board of governors is something that many LLCs in Minnesota have been formed with and sort of operate under. And we wanted to make sure that it was very clear that that could continue. So we added a board of governors and added some terminology to the statute that is doable. It's not the default rule. It doesn't, if people choose that, they can do that, but there's a clear pathway to do that under the Minnesota statute. We thought that was important for transition so that people, we didn't upset apple carts for folks that had had LLCs in existence for many years. I think otherwise we tried to take a good shot at making sure that all of the provisions that we need in the Act to work with our corporate statute 302A that was testified to on a separate bill earlier today were in place, that all of the things we need to have the Secretary of State's office work well with the statute were in place. We used some of our Minnesota terminology like articles of organization in this statute, which were different terminology in the standard statute. So we tried to adopt the provisions of it mostly, but then make it work in Minnesota the best way we could so we didn't, again, upset apple carts. The other thing that the committee was involved in is, as the study committee goes through the Bar Association process, is to take it from there to the business law section and have that group of lawyers, another group of lawyers that sort of broadens out the scope of folks that looked at this. They reviewed our work and our recommendation and approved it. It also went to various other segments of the Bar Association, the real estate group, the estate planning and probate group, and other folks that would have an impact. So all throughout the Bar Association, there was an opportunity for input and feedback on this statute as part of the MSBA putting its endorsement and recommendation that this statute be adopted. So that process has all gone through. Part of that process, we did get a little feedback. The Attorney General's office that was alluded to earlier wanted us to address the question of nonprofit LLCs and some questions regarding making sure that folks that confuse their individual self with their entity self, the bad actors of that that type might be still held liable for wrongful acts that defraud folks and other things along those lines. We took those considerations, those comments from the Attorney General's office, and got those incorporated into this draft of the bill. We also had a good dialogue and a fairly lengthy dialogue with part of the bar that is concerned very much about minority shareholder interests and those rights. And we worked out language and had dialogue with them about the provisions of the new act that protect those rights. And then we clarified some things that, and Senator Linder, you asked questions earlier about that definition of oppression. Well, that definition and that set of amendments came out of those discussions so that we made clear that we were doing what we could to be fair and balanced and to protect the rights of all of the shareholders or all of the members in an LLC. So that was, in a nutshell, the process from the Bar Association standpoint. And as a representative of that group, I can say that the Bar Association has approved this statute and would very much like to see it adopted in Minnesota.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Walker. Are there any questions? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could bring the committee's attention to page 58R. Now, this is the section that we're repealing. It's the current statute that we have, and if we could go to a subdivision 4, that would be section 833. I don't have a line number, but you can find it. That's second paragraph from the bottom. And this deals with determining whether a court can order relief, determining what particular, well, in, as they do that, the court will take into consideration the duty that all members would have in respect to the reasonable, what I would say, I think what it says is reasonable manner in the operation of the limited liability. I'm sorry, I'm off one line. The reasonable expectation of all members as they exist at the inception. Is there going to be any difference between what we are repealing and what would be in the new law regarding that particular subject?
Senator Letts, would you repeat the page?
Page 58R, subdivision 4 on the bottom. It's in the repealer section at the very back of the bill. Senator Sharon, you have to go all the way to the back of the bill and then find 58R.
Second paragraph from the bottom.
Professor Kleinberg.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, allow me to go just a little bit back in history to explain the context.
Not too far back, Professor.
Not too far back.
We have other items on the agenda.
Absolutely. Briefly, even though I'm an academic. In order to get limited liability 100 years ago, people had to form corporations. What they got with that was majoritarian rule. You got power based on how much money you put in and the majority rule. It would be like having the U.S. Constitution without a Bill of Rights. So over the years, there developed anti-oppression law, which is reflected here. In a contract-based organization, you don't start out with majoritarian rule. You start out with one person, one vote. You cannot be put in a position where you'll be oppressed unless you upfront agree to it. So the context is different. Also, under the corporate approach, if you have an understanding with your best friend for 20 years about how you're operating your business, but you don't write it down, under the current statute, that agreement's not enforceable as a contract. You have to prove not only the agreement, but you're being oppressed. That's not true under the new act. And even so, the important elements of this, this notion of honest, fair, and reasonable within the context of your agreement, were indeed incorporated into the author's amendment. And so the practicing lawyers who raise these concerns have signed off on it.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Lindner.
So, Professor, would you could you say that the new version in 1648 contains equivalent investor protection as you found in the existing law?
I think
Mr. Kleinberg.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer. I think it contains at least as good and in some ways better.
And Mr. Chair, and then in a related question, when you look at that same section of existing law, existing law provides a duty that all members owe each other to act in an honest and fair business manner in order to protect the stock or the equivalent investor protection. Would you also say that the existing law reflects the same application of law in the new version of the bill that we're considering?
Well, let me make
action, not just to the last question was more to respect a reasonable expectation.
Let me answer that, if I may, Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, in two parts. One is that language appears in the author's amendment in the context of the deal the investors make among themselves. So we're saying, yes, you have to act honest, fairly, and reasonable, given the deal you've made with each other. That's far more, by the way, than we give to a consumer when he or she makes a deal with the landlord. So it's really looking in to say you must not use the form of your deal to undercut the substance. And the other thing I would say is that more than any other judge in this state, Judge Lansing, when she was on the Court of Appeals, worked to rationalize and protect the position of minority shareholders. Many of the leading decisions have her name on them. And she was on this committee, and she influenced the discussion, and she signed off on it. So I am, if I put it another way, if I were representing on a contingency basis somebody who was claiming oppression, I prefer this statute to the other one. Now, others may disagree, but that's what I would do.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To any of the three testifiers, does this bill in any way address or affect limited liability partnerships?
No, not to my understanding. Not to my understanding, there would be the limited liability partnership statute, separate statute. The only intersection would be to the extent that they recognized for purposes of conversions or converting from one entity into the other. Not to my understanding.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I agree with that. There is one additional aspect, which is that this statute and the Uniform Partnership Act, which we have parallel structures, so that it will be easier for lawyers to learn this structure. And it also parallels our Limited Partnership Act as well. So there will be a synergy between the two.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Is it possible for you to give me an example of what might be considered oppression by a minority member?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, the classic example of oppression is the three senators, you form a business, and it's sort of essentially an understood that each of you is going to work in the business, and that's how you're going to get your money out of the business. And then your two colleagues, hypothetically speaking, decide they don't want you around anymore. So they use their voting power to fire you and say, by the way, we're not declaring any distributions. That's classic. Under a corporate structure, you need an oppression remedy to get to that. You know, absent a contrary agreement, they have the right because they have presumably two-thirds of the vote. Under this act, unless there's been an agreement, every significant, like out-of-the-ordinary decision requires unanimous consent, and certainly firing a founder is an extraordinary decision. So without having to show oppression, you would have an action against them.
Senator Sherman.
Will there be a situation in which a minority member is able to prohibit the partners from engaging in an action that they simply disagree with it, so they engage in complete capacity to control a decision-making process as an individual in the partnership?
Professor Kleinberg.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharon, that actually is one of the concerns about the current act, because since it doesn't recognize any agreements except those which are in written shareholder control agreements, and so you have to move to this oppression unfairly prejudicial thing, and it's somewhat open-ended that you go into court and say, well, judge, this is not really what is nice for me. And you don't have to win, by the way, on that. You just have to get by summary judgment, and you have to be bought out. But generally speaking, unless you can show, and I think it's true under this act as well, some very serious interest of yours that is either been expressly agreed to or is, from the facts established, central to the reason you got into the deal or stayed into the deal, then you can go to court, but you're not going to win, or you shouldn't win. Is that responsive?
Right. Senator Sharon?
Yes, thank you.
All right. Any further questions on this bill? I'm not seeing any. Senator Newman, make the motion.
Be happy to.
All right. Senator Newman moves that Senate File 1648 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor. Not seeing any further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Franzen.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, members.
Senator Wicklund. Senate File 1698. Pass it out.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Yes, I'm here today to present Senate File 1698, which is to modify juvenile treatment screening timelines. This bill, it modifies the timeline for making decisions on out-of-home placements for juveniles in order to make them the same between the PMAPs, the prepaid medical assistance programs, and the counties. Out-of-home placements are needed when a child's mental illness requires the level of care provided in residential treatment. The county pays for their room and board, and then the health plan pays for the treatment. We want to have both the county and health plan move quickly so children can transition out of the hospital or shelter settings into appropriate treatment. Having the same timeline will make it easier for people to remember that that is the timeline. This change was recommended by a working group at DHS, and they were working to improve children's discharge or transition to the community. I do have an amendment to provide some additional clarifying language, and I don't know if you have that yet. But
yes, the author's amendment has been passed out. Why don't you go ahead and explain the author's amendment? It's changing a one-word bill to a multi-word bill. Better clarify.
Chair Latz, I apologize for that. But it was in order to bring all the parties into complete agreement with the bill, and so we added some additional language.
Why don't you explain it, Senator?
And I will let Sue Ebderholden, the executive director at NAMI, explain the a little more background and then the amendment language.
Ms. Ebderholden.
Yes, thank you, Senator Letts. Sue Ebderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. What the amendment does is actually narrow who the 10-day timeline applies to. We have been working with the counties to make sure that they were okay with this, and initially the language, just changing it from 15 to 10, made it too broad for all the different types of screenings that, that come through the county. So we wanted to make it very clear that it's only when a child is on prepaid medical assistance and they need the county to pay for the room and board of residential treatment, so it actually narrows who that timeline applies to. And again, we think this is a good idea. There were, over 40-some people who were part of this task force trying to improve the discharge planning. If you think about the cost of a day at an inpatient unit for children's psychiatric, it's very, very expensive. So we want to make sure that we're moving children quickly out of that hospital bed by having both the county and the PMAT move quickly to make those decisions. And every day, you know, the child's in that bed when they should be somewhere else is a bed that's not open to some other child. So it's just really trying to move our system forward. And Mary Regan, who represents the residential providers and day treatment providers, is here as well, who understands it even better than I do.
Thank you. Ms. Regan, do you care to add anything?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mary Regan with the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies. No, I think both Senator Wicklund and Sue Ebderholden have described this accurately. It's simply saying the same timelines need to be followed by the health plan and the county. The counties are in agreement with this, and it will essentially make the transition for children who need these services simpler and smoother and timely.
Senator Lemmer.
I'm confused. I'm looking at the amendment, and you said you wanted to make the timelines the same. But we're reinstating on line 2, reinstating 15 days. And then on line 5, if the child is enrolled in a health program, then the screening must be conducted within 10. So I'm confused. You described it that the working timeline was supposed to be the same. I don't read it this way. Can you explain further?
I can, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Regan.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, by the same, I mean the timelines for the health plan decision and the timelines for the county decision. In statute, the health plans are required to make a decision within 10 days of the request. And right now, counties get 15 days. For those situations where a child is covered by a health plan and the county, and those decisions have to be made jointly, this is what the amendment does. It says in those situations, the timeline would be 10 days.
Any further questions?
I'll move the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer moves the author's amendment, the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. No known opposition at this point to this bill? Anyone in the room want to testify for or against? Any further questions from committee members? Seeing none, Senator Limmer. Move
yes,
the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1698 as amended be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
As far as I know, this goes to the floor.
Floor.
Any further discussion? All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dietzick, Senate File 1770, Government Data Practices Act. Senator Dietzick.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for hearing this bill. Senate File 1770 clarifies application of the Government Data Practices Act to parties contracting with a government entity. The Minnesota Government Data Practices Act states that when a private firm contracts with a government entity, any data created, collected, received, stored, used, or disseminated under the contract is subject to the Government Data Practices Act. A question arose in a case in St. Louis County that went all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court. The question, did the legislature intend for the obligation to comply with the Act only in situations where the contract contained a notice that all the data was subject to the Act? The Supreme Court ruled that the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act should contain express language and impose direct obligation if that was the intent. This bill clarifies that all contracts entered into a government entity must include the notice and that the requirements of the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act apply and that failure to include the notice does not invalidate the application of the subdivision. With me today is Mr. Mark Anfinson, attorney for the Newspaper Association. He can give us more background on the case and on the issues. And I believe Ms. Lori Beyer-Kapinski from the Department of Admin is also here, and she can also clarify some of the issues. And then I believe we also have some other testifiers on the bill.
Senator Dietzick, you do have an author's amendment. Is that correct, the A1
yes.
amendment?
Yes.
Members, it is in your packet. This puts the bill in the form you'd like it to be in for our consideration.
Yes, thank you.
Anything that you wish to explain specifically about the author's amendment?
My understanding is that this actually, you have the before the Supreme Court case, and then they actually raised the questions on if this, if the intent of this language, if the notice is not in there, if we should still be, if the contract should still be subject to the Act, and this. My understanding is this amendment just gets us back to where we were before. So it's not actually expanding or limiting anything. It's just getting us back to where we were before.
Where we thought the law was
correct.
Before the Supreme Court Act.
Yes, correct.
Right. Senator Dietzick moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Mr. Anfinson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members. Mark Anfinson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association. Thanks, Senator Dietzick, for carrying this bill. I'm going to be pretty condensed here, but this is, of course, data practices, everyone's favorite topic. And so there are inevitable complexities. The bill, especially the delete everything, is a response directly to the Supreme Court's opinion that that didn't just interpret this statute differently than we thought it should be interpreted, but it overturned 15 years of settled law in Minnesota. There had been a large number of authoritative interpretations of this statute that came to a different conclusion than the Supreme Court did in November 2013. And so we're here to try, we really are here to restore the law to what everybody thought it was as a matter of good practice and rationality. And I know that's the first time a legislative committee has ever been asked to do something like this in response to the Supreme Court. So to be clear, we have the delete everything that you've approved, and we, in trying to persuade folks that this is a good idea, have circulated the proposal widely. We've given it to the local government representatives, the contractors groups, the engineers groups, the Council of Health Plans, and just a couple of hours ago, we talked to the Kathy Haney, who represents the architects. As of now, they're all neutral. They're with the delete everything language on the bill, including the architects. So what is the essence of the proposal? The essence of the proposal is to correct what is a serious breach now in this important statute. And you will often hear, because I am the attorney for the Newspaper Association, you will be tempted to assume that this is mostly about public access to government data held by contractors. It's not. The far bigger impact of what the Supreme Court did is to strip away privacy protections for data held by contractors, okay? Because what the Supreme Court said is that if a contract between a government agency and a vendor does not contain a reference to Section 13.05, Subdivision 11, stating that data held by the contractor is subject to the Data Practices Act, if that notice isn't in the contract, not only is there no public access to the contractor-held data relating to the contract, but the privacy protections are not present on the contractor either. Quick example. Let's say this is a very common one, an IT vendor contracts with the state or local agency to do website work for the agency, school district. They'll come into the possession of a ton of highly sensitive private data in the course of performing their work for the agency. Under the Supreme Court's ruling, if that contract between that vendor and the, let's say, the county does not contain this notice, the contractor's not subject to the privacy rules of the Data Practices Act, basically. And in addition, and this is our specific concern, the contractor doesn't have to provide public access to contract performance data, okay? So this law was enacted in 1999. As early as 2001, the Information Policy Analysis Division, Ms. Beyer-Kaprensky's current division in the Department of Administration, construed this statute to say the following. Even if a government contract does not contain the notice language, that notice must be inferred. It's presumed to be there anyway, and the contract subject to this law. That was the consistent view of IPAD for 10, 12 years in a series of probably 10 advisory opinions. Then in 2003, the Court of Appeals took up that same issue in a case called WDSI versus Steele County and ruled the same way. There was no notice in the contract there. They said, hey, we end up with an irrational process if some contracts are subject to the Data Practices Act and some aren't. So that was the law. That was subtle law. That's what the Supreme Court upended. Now, how did that happen? Very briefly. In 2010, the largest geographical school district in the state in St. Louis County was doing a big school construction project. Johnson Controls was the contractor. In the course of the contract, the local newspaper publisher, a man named Marshall Helmberger, who I'm going to say very quickly has a connection to someone sitting in on that side of the table because your esteemed counsel once babysat Marshall Helmberger, as I understand. It's bizarre, but true. And it should be part of the record here. And anyway, Mr. Helmberger, as Ms. Pontius knows, is a guy who believes in doing the right thing. So
we won't let Ms. Pontius vote on this bill, then.
I think she's got a serious conflict here. So, again, What happens in this $80 million school construction project is the editor, Marshall Helmberger, begins learning that there are significant cost overruns in the contract, that the school board is being asked to approve payment for, running high over the contract. Helmberger wants to know why. He is told informally that it's an architectural design issue, as school officials understand it, that's causing the cost overruns. Helmberger then says, well, doesn't the architect, the subcontractor architect here, have some indemnification responsibility back to the taxpayers? And so he doesn't get a clear answer, and he thus makes a simple request to Johnson Controls, under this statute, can I get a copy of the architectural subcontract? It's contract performance data. And he's told no. Johnson Controls won't give it to him. That sets off almost a three-year legal fight, which ends up in the Supreme Court last fall. The Court of Appeals rules, I litigated the case for Mr. Helmberger and his newspapers. The Court of Appeals reaffirms the law. It says even if the contract doesn't have the notice, the contract is subject to the statute. But the Supreme Court gets the last word, and they rule in, as I say, November 2013, that because this contract with Johnson Controls had no notice in it, by the way, it was drafted by Johnson Controls, none of the Data Practices Act's provisions as stated in 1305 subdivision 11 applied. And that's the law right now. So you have this is my own term. Others can come to their own conclusions. But it's somewhat irrational status in Minnesota, whereas if a government contract, if an agency complies with what this statute says and puts the notice in its contract, that's what this contract says it's supposed to do, it's subject to this law. But if the agency or the contractor don't comply with the statute, they're off the hook. And so the simple function of the and that, again, opens this door, especially on the protection of private data held by vendors as well as public access. So the simple purpose to delete everything is to say even if the contract doesn't contain a written notice, the law still applies. And, again, that's what we all thought was the case before. Now, one final point, and Ms. Beyer-Kaprinsky can expand on this. This will have considerable application at the local level because for some reason many local contracts just don't get this notice in them. They haven't. Although part of that's due to the fact that the law had been interpreted to infer them anyway, so you didn't need to put them in. But for at least 12 years, all state-level agency contracts have had this notice in every one because the Department of Administration has promulgated a contract form that properly includes the language. So, again, this won't impact state agencies at all for all intents and purposes. But,
all right.
Well, you've heard enough from me, I suspect, so I'll be happy to answer any questions, but that's the gist of what we're trying to do here.
Thank you, Mr. Anfinson. Ms. Beyer-Kaprinsky.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members. Lori Barkopensky, Department of Administration. And I'm the Director of Community Services. And ADMIN is a really diverse agency, and we've got lots of things in it, including procurement, which is contracts. We also have grants management, one of the areas that I oversee, as well as the state demographer and lots of other areas. But what I wanted to verify is we were all really surprised by the Supreme Court decision, and we knew that at least the application of it to state contracts and grants was going to be minimal because all of our contract shell agreements include that language. And the concurrence pointed out is the state of the law right now is that people are given a roadmap on how to screen data and how to make sure the Data Practices Act isn't going to be included. So we are really appreciative of the committee wanting to address this in some fashion. It certainly doesn't answer all the questions that have been involved in this language, even the way we all thought the law meant before. But this certainly closes a loophole and ensures that data where government money is paid, that there is going to be some transparency.
Thank you. Any questions for either of these testifiers? Mm-hmm. Senator Goodwin.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate this bill coming forward. We really do need a lot more controls over government contracts. And in addition to the issue that you brought up, there's just a lot of other issues of quality control or lack thereof of contracts bidding out one price and then coming in with changes and addendums and increasing the cost of the contract significantly. And I personally like the role of the media in looking into some of that, because it's a rat's nest, and it's really hard. And I've looked at this issue for 20 years, and it's really hard to pin it down oftentimes. So when you do that, when you perform that role, that's a real public benefit to perform that role. So I just want to tell you that this is a good bill, and I'd like to work with you on some other contracting provisions.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodman, I'll tell you, there was just 2 hours of very stressful testimony and debate in the House this morning on some contractor bills, so they're not all this simple. I do know that, but it is an important issue.
All right. To see no further questions of these testifiers, thank you, Ms. Byer-Krupinski and Mr. Anfinson.
Thank you, Chairman.
Rich Neumeister and Don Gemberling, why don't you both come on forward? You signed up to testify in connection with this bill. Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll just talk straight as I try to do. In 1999 or 98, basically there was a big study about data practices and update. This body, the Senate, appointed me and Senator Jean Merriam, former Senator Jean Merriam, to represent the Senate, and the House did, and the governor did their things. As part of the recommendation that former Senator Merriam and I pushed, and one or two others, was we need some accountability of how millions and billions of dollars of public monies are going out to private contractors, and what would happen, you would end up in these situations. So let's say the parent wants to know, with a private contractor, with the school district who's driving their bus, they want to know the name of the driver. Sorry, can't tell you that. We can tell you the first name, but not the last name. But people sometimes are interested to know the name, you know, of a bus driver who's contracting out with a school district to maybe do their own background check if they so desire to do that. But what they were being told, saying, I'm sorry, you know, we don't have the contract. You got to talk to the XYZ bus company to get the name. But then they'll tell you they're not under data practices. I'll give you another example. As you know, there are hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe millions of dollars, done with consultant studies that affect neighborhoods, affect states, and all that. So they'll give a few $100,000 or $1 million money to do some kind of study that may affect your neighborhood. And what happens, the public body or the government, they'll get a 400-page report or maybe a 50-page report, but none of the data that underlies how they came to those conclusions. And so what was happening is that people, neighbors, interested people who live in a community, that depending on what the subject of the consultant report wanted to know, how did you get there? I'm sorry, government say, we don't have the data. ABC Consultant Company has it. Go and get them. You go to them, and what they would say, sorry, we're not under data practices. So I'm just trying to give you a sense of how this came about and why we're at it here today. Now, my point is that I think this gets to where the basis of the law is. I mean, I use it quite a bit in my data request. I'm right now in a big fight with the Department of Public Safety, who has a contract with Harris Corporation where they've spent $600,000 of public money about a secret device called the Kingfisher Stingray, and they tell me I can't get nothing on it. That's another issue, and I'm working with folks on that. But I'll give you a story of why it's important to keep this kind of information, and this gets into the story about some of the other folks that was referred to in Mr. Avinson's testimony. As you know, I've been around a long time, and I always come in, and even today I said, hey, are you here on the Timber J deal or whatever? Because, again, some of the things, some people have some concerns. 22 years ago.
I was going to ask you to focus the story.
Yeah, that's what I do.
Because we have
that's what it is.
To get to. Thank you.
I opposed caller ID. And U.S. West came in, and with the PUC, they said, all this information is proprietary information. You can't get, you know, and told the PUC and Public Service Department, that was called at that time, it's all trade secret proprietary. Well, I talked to the Attorney General and a few other folks. I said, that's nonsense. Our law gives protection to proprietary data, trade secrets, but we have a law that's been on the books for some 30 years. So I asked that information for the AG to take a look at it. All of a sudden, 80% of the data was public. so then the public could get a more of an idea what US West was trying to do with caller ID. Now, one of the issues underlying here, and whether or not someone will say it publicly or not, is there are some attempts to maybe put proprietary somewhere in the, it may not happen here, but there are a number of people who have an interest to make it proprietary. And if we do that, and I hope you don't do that, it will be a bad thing for public accountability and transparency and scrutiny. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I encourage you to support this bill, and I give you some background. I think hopefully it will give you a little bit more reason why to vote positive for the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Minister. Mr. Gemberling.
Mr. Chairman, Don Gemberling from the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. We're the transparency people. So all volunteers, we try and assure the public gets as much access to government data as it needs to hold its government accountable for what it does. We strongly support the bill correcting what the Supreme Court did. I won't say what I've said about what the Supreme Court did in other forums. I just, you know, it's like, how did they get there? It seemed to me that they just wanted to not deal with the real issue, and so they found a strange way to duck it. But as you've heard from other testifiers, this produces all kinds of strange results. And I'll just tell you one story emphasizing what Mr. Amphison said, that this is more than just about public access to information. The first time I ever encountered a privatization issue was a young man came to my office, I'm going to say in about 1980. He had applied to be a bus driver at the Metropolitan Transit Commission. He had been denied employment because of the psychological profile testing they had done on him. And he was really quite upset, and reasonably so. And I said, well, you know, under our act, this information is private and it's available to you. And he said very clearly, and I'll say very bluntly, yeah, I try to get it. But what they told me was they contract that out with a company in Chicago. And then if I wanted the data, I had to go to Chicago to get it. So, and this, this is one of those guys that just sticks in my head as somebody who really was trying to find out what was happening to him. He went to Chicago. He marched into the company. He demanded access to the data. They told him they weren't subject to the Data Practices Act, and they threw him out. Okay? And after that, there were provisions added to the Data Practices Act to deal with some of the contract aspects, but this was the large one that, as somebody mentioned, went into effect in 1999. After considerable discussion in one of the reform movements in looking at the Data Practices Act. So thank you, Senator Dietzick. This really does need to be done, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members of the committee from Mr. Gemberling or from Mr. Neumeister, who's still in the room? I'll just note for the record, the Supreme Court had before it a legal question of statutory interpretation. They reached their conclusion unanimously. But what we have before us is a public policy question, what the law ought to be, and that will be the basis for our consideration here today. So we also have signed up to testify Steve Lindemann. Mr. Lindemann, come on forward.
Thank you, members of the committee. I'm the lone voice, apparently, to speak against this, and let me tell you why. I represented Architectural Resources in the Helmberger case and argued it to the Supreme Court. Mr. Anfinson was involved in that case as well, so we had all kinds of discussions and arguments along the way. And I believe there's no need to change the law at all, that it's perfectly fine the way it is. And I happen to believe that the Supreme Court got it right, and let me tell you why. First, the majority decided that if the language that is specified in the law is not included in the contract, there's not sufficient notice to the contractor that it's subject to the Government Data Practices Act. And there was concern that it's unfair to make the contractor or anyone who's contracting with the government subject to that act if they don't know that they are doing something that would make them fall under the act. Really, the provision at issue here, Subdivision 11, is about privatization. Now, the original proposed language here that was before you, and that's been amended, but the original language was to make any contract subject to the Government Data Practices Act. That's a far cry from privatization. I agree with the examples about the bus driver and, you know, if there's some sort of traditional government function that is privatized, you cannot cloak within the veil of secrecy the information that would otherwise be in front of the government. It would be in the possession of the government, and it should be subject to public access. But things that have not traditionally been public functions, such as designing schools, building schools, those are things that have been contracted to private parties for decades. My client was the architect who was a subcontractor to Johnson Controls Architectural Resources, and it went through great trouble in this case to protect information that would otherwise have been sought by Mr. Helmberger and his client. And it's the sort of information that would make it difficult to compete with others, you know, information about how it does its pricing, how it does its own subcontracting, the sort of thing that traditionally is not accessible to the public, whether it's a competitor, a newspaper, or just some curious member of the public who wants to see what's in the files. Where does it stop? All of their communications, anything that they use in connection with working on the project would be subject to disclosure. Now, there was another aspect to the Supreme Court decision that was set forth in the concurrence by Justice Page, joined by Justice Wright. Justice Page determined that providing design and construction services was not a government function. It was not something that was traditionally performed by the government, and firms who were providing those sorts of services would not be subject to the Act. But that was not the majority opinion. But what it points out is that this is not the sort of thing that is typically the concern of the public and something that the public needs access to. Everything that's in the government's files certainly should be subject to public access. But what's down the chain, subcontractor, supplier, like I said, it doesn't stop. Now, in the Supreme Court argument, Mr. Anfinson argued that it's hard to imagine a government contract that does not involve a government function. That's what the original language in this bill reflected, this approach that if there's a contract with the government, that means there should be full access to the private company's files. That's bad for business in Minnesota, and it's ultimately bad for government in Minnesota because it will discourage contractors who would otherwise do business with the government. Now, the new version of the bill simply defers that issue. It kicks it down the road to be determined later. If the contract does not have the notice provision in, this new bill would say the contractor is still subject to the Data Practices Act. So the contractor who doesn't believe it's performing a government function is doing its work, it's going along, and all of a sudden it's getting requests for information, like I said, from a newspaper, from a competitor, from a member of the public, and it has to deal with that. The question is it performing a government function or not? Well, my client went through a lot of litigation to get to the point where it was determined that they were not. I believe that keeping this notice provision as a required part of the statute that actually means something would mean that the government entity and the contractor up front would to determine, is this a government function or not? If it is, there are a lot of things that flow from that. That means, you know, the contractor is going to have someone who is responsible for complying with the Data Practices Act. They have to have an inventory of their information. They have to provide a policy as to how they'll provide access. They have to update that policy every year. There are a lot of things that go along with being subject to the Government Data Practices Act, and they should know what they're getting into. If this bill is passed the way it is, there'll be a lot of businesses out there that will enter into contracts having no idea that they're subject to the Data Practices Act, and then they'll get these requests. I think they should know up front whether they are or they aren't, and I think that clients like mine who are performing architectural services on a public project should not have their files be subject to the Data Practices Act. And maybe this doesn't seem like a big deal to you, but it's a big deal for a lot of businesses who are going to have a lot of headaches associated with complying with this. And in addition to all of those duties, they're subject to civil damages, they're subject potentially to punitive damages, and they're subject to criminal penalties. It's a misdemeanor. If you are subject to the Data Practices Act as if you're the government and you do not comply, that can be a misdemeanor. So I think the implications are great, and I disagree that this simply puts the law back where it was. I think the Supreme Court got it right. I think the legislature had it right when it first put this provision in the statute, and I think it should mean something. So I would urge this committee to seriously consider the implications of this bill and to leave the law as it stands. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lindemann. Senator Dziedzic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank you, Mr. Lindemann, for coming and talking. What I believe, and I will give you some of my background on for agreeing to author this, is because I have concerns that you could have, and I'm not going to get all conspiratorial or anything like that, but I think there are instances where you may have government or you may have an entity deciding, I do not want to be part of the this act, and so they set up a subcontract or a contract with a subcontract to do the loophole, and I think this just sets it out that this is the way it is. And I think some of the questions that you raised and some of others have raised and literally looking at what is government function, I think that is a longer conversation than where we are here today. And I, you know, quite frankly, in this short session, I think that would take a lot of time. And so I think that's something that does need to be addressed and should be addressed. Like you said, kicking it down the line, I think that's something that I think over the interim, you know, it should be looked at, because I think that it's still, I mean, those questions, my understanding is those questions were there before, and I think we need to address them. This does not address that, but in my understanding, this just says it goes back to where people thought they were before.
That's pretty good. Mr. Anfelson, you wish to respond?
Yeah, if I could, Mr. Chairman, members, just very quickly. I respect Mr. Lindemann's concerns and the concerns he expressed on behalf of his clients. Okay, nobody discounts those or dismisses those. But what he is complaining about, in essence, is current law, the way the statute is now, and the way the statute, as I testified before, had been consistently interpreted by IPAD and the courts for almost 15 years. That's what the law was. And many of the grievances he has now that he announces to you never happened. One of the arguments I made at every level of court we went through here, and there were three of them, was the following. Because they used this terrible deterrent to Minnesota business argument throughout the litigation. And my response was the following. If indeed these terrible negative effects on Minnesota businesses had occurred because of the way the law had been interpreted, where was the evidence that they had happened? Why had there never been a single bill introduced here in any of those 13 years to correct this big problem? They never responded with anything whatsoever. There never was a bill. There never was a proposal to fix this interpretation. This was the law for many years. There was no consequence. Now, maybe it'll come, and maybe the legislature should look at this again. But as Senator Dziedzic correctly points out, our goal here today is much more humble. It's to restore the law to what it was. And if the law itself is flawed, that's a conversation we're happy to engage in. One other quick point. This doesn't give the public the right to plow through all of a private business's records in any remote sense. All it applies to is data directly related to performance of a government contract. Secondly, it doesn't come anywhere close to saying that subcontractor data is subject to this law. It doesn't say that at all. Subcontractors are beyond the reach of the statute. In the Johnson Controls case, the one that went to the Supreme Court, the reason a subcontract was at issue was because Architectural Resources had given a copy of its subcontract to Johnson Controls, the general contractor. We made the request to the general. Nobody ever sought data from a subcontractor, and under the law, as it's been construed and still is, nobody can. So that's the response.
Can I just respond very briefly? Yes. Two things. Mr. Anfinson said that this had never come up. It wasn't a concern. Nobody ran back to the legislature. That's true. It's because these type of requests were not being made in this same way. I've been doing construction law for 23 years, and I've never had clients who've been in this position before, and I have not heard in the construction industry about a problem. The reason why this was a problem was Marshall Helmberger was upset about what was happening with the plan to renovate and remodel and close some schools, and he was looking into that. Whatever the motivations were, he did not like what was going on. So he was making these requests, trying to raise some issues that would cause concern and bring the whole project into question. That's the sort of thing that can abuse this process. Whether it was in this case or not, it has the potential to be abused. And it had not been for the last several years. This just had not come up. So there was no reason to come to the legislature. Once it got to the Supreme Court, they made the right decision. Now they're coming back to the legislature to get another bite at the apple. If I were a newspaper, I'd want to get access to all the files I could, too. You can, write some good stories if you can dig up some things that are embarrassing to people. And the second point is this applies to all of the data created, collected, received, stored, used, maintained, or disseminated by the private person in connection with that work. So anything that my client uses, emails internally, emails with subcontractors, pricing information that it's gathered for 20 years to figure out how to price its services. All of that, I think, is potentially subject to that kind of request. Now, that's one of the things that we'd need to address down the road if this goes through and it's applied in the way that I think it will be applied. How do you protect that sort of information? I think that's an incredibly burdensome thing to expect Minnesota businesses who want to do good work for government to have to be subject to. And so I really think this is going to be a problem, and we'll be either in litigation or back here. And while it may be good for me in my practice, it's not good for my clients.
Senator Lance.
That's a good one.
I have a couple of comments and questions. One is, if you were contracting with a federal, on a federal contract, you'd have a lot stiffer rules than what we have here in Minnesota, and our contracting laws are pretty easy, pretty laid back. And I'm just thinking that any company that is actually applying for a government contract should have an attorney to advise them if they don't want to look through the statutes themselves and find out what their responsibilities are. That should be up to the contractor to make sure they know what their legal responsibilities are in a government contract. When you're a contractor taking public money, whether it's through a general contractor or through a subcontractor, you're taking public money for the project. And I'm aware of other contract management firms that know and understand the laws that they have to follow when they build schools and jails. And I'm thinking, I don't know why this should be a problem. We should certainly know and be able to, and if the issue was, and it sounds like it was, try to get at the price difference, the changes in the cost to the project, whatever way they have to get at that, that should be available to them. And I don't know the case well enough to know, but it sounds to me like that's exactly what they were looking for, was where those costs had gone up and what part of the contract they had gone up. And that should be public information. And it actually surprises me that the district didn't have this information and have copies of the contracts and so forth, and the subcontractors as well, because they certainly should have if they didn't. And there's got to be some way to make sure that your clients know what the law is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gooden, I might say that's why Mr. Helmberger went to Johnson Controls, because he asked the school district first, can you pull up a copy of the subcontract so I can see if we have some indemnification? And they wouldn't do it. That's why this law was here in the first place. By the way, we've talked to Senator Betzold, Representative McGuire, who were the authors of this legislation in 1999. They agree that the approach taken by Senator Dedzic is directly reflective of their original intent. And one final offer, Mr. Chairman. We would, as long as we're at it, we, Mr. Lindemann and I could kind of reenact our Supreme Court argument. I mean, we've done part of it, but we can keep going if you'd like.
I was about to make the analogy myself and to indicate that's not our role here.
Could we consider adjournment, Mr. Chairman?
Not before my bills are passed. I still got two bills ahead of us on the agenda. Mr. Ayling, did you want to add something here real quickly?
Thanks again.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, Matt Ayling with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. I hear the concerns expressed by Mr. Lindemann, but I would note this. I come up here as a volunteer to advocate for public transparency. In my private life, I'm a private businessman. I work in the communications business. And I am occasionally a party subject to the Data Practices Act. When this contract that I hold in my hand here was for a lecture that I gave at Minneapolis Community College. It contains a notice provision saying that what I produced during the course of that lecture is public information and should be available to the public. And I think, and I have no problem with that. That is as it should be. I willingly contracted with the government to perform a function, and I think the taxpayers of Minnesota should know what I did. And I think that applies to $200 contracts like this just as much as it applies to multi-million dollar contracts for road repair and other functions. So I hear the concerns raised by private businesses, but private businesses should be aware that they are performing public functions open to public scrutiny when they contract with the government. Mm-hmm. I'd be happy to take any other questions.
Thank you. Mr. Ayling, I think you're probably undercharged for your services. I'm actually a little surprised to see that private subcontractors are not included in this. At least that seems to be the consensus here. That might be a topic for another day. But let's see if there's anyone else that wishes to testify on this at this time. Any questions from members of the committee or discussion on the bill at this time? All right, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Ealing.
Thank you.
Senator Dietzick. See, we adopted your A1 amendment. So at this point, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I move the adoption of Senate File 1770 as amended. I don't know.
And that'd be re-referred to state and local government, I understand. Is that correct?
Yep.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right.
Thank you,
Senator Dietzick. Senator Goodwin, if you come over and take over the chair.
I guess I kind of remember. Practices.
Those handouts in there. Chair and the former vice chair in there.
Questions and to have lost half the committee.
I remember this one.
They have confidence in you.
So are you, by the way.
Senator Latz, Senate File 2044.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Madam Chair, Senate File 2044 relates to the timing of getting expert review certification in certain civil lawsuits, statutory adjustment to reflect amendments to Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 26. And with me a couple of testifiers that can give a little more detailed explanation who are experienced in practicing in this area of the law. But I will tell you that with one minor adjustment to the bill, as far as we know, there will be no organized opposition to it. So I would like to move as an author's amendment that on line 2.2, we strike or delete the words against the defendant. And I can explain the basis for that request, Madam Chair.
2.2.
The Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association expressed a little bit of concern that with that language in there, that a plaintiff could initiate discovery and commence the deadline or the timeline from running. And though there's some uncertainty whether or not that could happen or would happen, but it's of no consequence to delete that language to ensure that it's not a loophole, if you will. So if we agree to remove those three words, I'm informed that the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association also does not oppose this bill. So you got the plaintiffs and the defendants would all be in agreement in the Senate file. So I make that motion, Madam Chair, as an author's amendment.
Senator Letts moves to amend his bill with an author's amendment. Any questions on that amendment? All in favor?
Oh, I just had a question on 2.31. That stays the same.
Council has one question.
Oh. Madam Chair, Senator, I just had a question on 2.31. It looks like kind of parallel language. Was that supposed to stay in against the defendant there? Or?
Madam Chair, I'd like to amend my amendment to add also on line 2.31, delete the words against the defendant. Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Senator Latz. And does anybody have any questions on that? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Adopted.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Melissa Wendland, an associate at Robbins, Kaplan, Miller, and Cerisi, to explain the bill.
Ms. Wendland?
Senators, Melissa Wendland. I live in Arden Hills with my husband and three kids. I am an associate at Robbins, Kaplan, Miller, and Cerisi. I've been practicing for 9 years there, almost 9 years. I represent families and individuals primarily in medical negligence cases. Very briefly, the two statutes that are being amended today deal with professional negligence. 145.682 deals with medical negligence, and then 544.42 deals with other professional negligence: attorneys, architects, CPAs, engineers, land surveyors, and landscape architects. In both of these statutes, essentially what is required that there needs to be an expert. Architect case, you need to have an expert architect. So what is required is that there generally is an affidavit. It's something under oath, a statement under oath by the expert after reviewing information in the case. 145.682 was enacted in 1986, and there's been some changes throughout the years, but essentially the 180-day deadline for the expert affidavit has not changed since 1986. And what is required for that 180 days is that right when the case commences in Minnesota State Court, which means right when the defendant is served with the summons and complaint, that the plaintiff has 180 days from commencement
to serve an expert affidavit. And this is going to be after the parties have been able to exchange information. This is during a time frame called discovery. So exchange information by written questions, documents, or depositions. And then the expert takes all that information and is able to give their fair and honest assessment of the case. Now, on July 1st, 2013, the Minnesota Supreme Court made a number of changes to the Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure and the Minnesota Rules Governing District Courts. And one of the rule changes that they made is that no party, no one, can get any information from any source until a certain time frame is gone through after you've served your summons and complaint, so after commencement now. You can't get any information, take depositions, exchange information, get documents for a time frame. And I can go into detail, but essentially it's going to be at least 50 days, if not more, after you file the summons and complaint. So now our 180-day deadline is now considerably shortened because of the amendments to the Supreme Court. So what these amendments do is that when the Supreme Court made these changes, they did not cross-reference these amendments for the 180 days. And so the amendments restore the legislative intent of the 180-day deadline and return basically it to the status quo. And the reason the 180 days is important is because if there's not enough information to give to your expert and that affidavit is insufficient, a case, no matter how meritorious it is, a child dies, someone's left with a brain injury or a paraplegic, the case is dismissed with prejudice, which means it's gone forever and can never be brought back. So, again, this is a conformity amendment to return that timeline to the status quo. I would appreciate your support on Senate File 2044, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Senator Newman.
Just an observation to maybe help members of the committee. This idea of requiring expert review in professional malpractice cases is an effort and that has been around for a very long time to, for lack of better wording, to weed out claims that don't have merit. And so when we see this kind of a bill coming forward, what we're really dealing with is just that issue, is does a case have merit? And I think that without, when I look at this, without endorsing and passing this bill, we would be in effect interfering with the ability of the parties, both defendants and the plaintiffs, in determining whether or not the case has merit and whether it should go forward. So I would support this bill.
Thank you. Any other? Senator Sheeran?
Yes. Thank you. Can you help me understand what was the motivation behind the rule change at the Supreme Court, rules of procedure changes that occurred administratively to delay depositions for 50 days?
Madam Chair and Senator Sherman,
Ms. Whitman.
The Supreme Court made a number of changes to the Minnesota Rules of Procedure. They had a task force that was enacted to try to make civil cases more streamlined and to affect those. This generally is a rule in federal court that discovery is delayed, where you can't take depositions, you can't exchange information for a certain amount of time frame. The difference in federal court is that they do not have medical negligence cases. They don't have expert affidavit time frames where that's required. So there was a number of those changes that were made that were more specific to federal court practice that don't take into account some particulars for state law cases like medical and other professional negligence cases.
Senator Goodwin.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sheeran.
Senator Sheeran. I'm sorry, did I pronounce your name wrong?
It's Senator. Fine. I like that other name, too. So
I apologize.
I answer to a lot of them. I heard what you said, but it didn't help me understand what the value of that delay is. What does it shorten the discovery time so that in the process of resolving issues in front of the court that there isn't this long, lengthy, constant, ongoing request for discovery of information? Is that what is trying to be contained by that procedure rule changing? And if that's true, I do share a concern about how much time is given and how a case can be dragged out because it extends a discovery time and the cost to those who may not have as much resources. So I'm not certain that that issue that I am concerned about is appropriate or relevant in this situation. But that's why I want to know. Why did the court establish a period of time in which depositions or other discovery is the term, that delays discovery for 50 days. There's got to be an explanation for what value that has.
Madam Chair and Senator, at Robbins, I also practice in patent litigation, and so I was only in federal court at the beginning of my practice. What my understanding is and what my practice has been in federal court and state court, but in federal court with these cases, is that the time frame for discovery is just lengthened this way, as in for that time frame before you meet and confer with the other parties. Often the delay happens because you are required to basically meet plaintiff defendant or required to meet to go over specifically issues with discovery, like electronically stored information. How are you going to produce that? Are you storing it? When I give you information, when I was representing Medtronic and Best Buy, when I produce the information, am I producing it in a manner that your electronic discovery service at your law firm can read it? So it's essentially so you can take time to meet and confer about specifics of large business cases and how to produce the information and when. Maybe there's time frames you're also talking about the case and how many depositions you need. But discovery then, instead of starting at the beginning, it's still the same amount of time frame. It's just delayed as to when it starts. And they usually do that to kind of account for large business cases. And that was my practice in federal court. In negligence cases, I'm finding with state court, often we're producing, we don't have a large volume of documents. It's medical records and maybe a handful more documents. So the need to delay really isn't there, but then also the discovery time frame has never changed. It's just when it starts. So discovery in federal court and Minnesota state court, it's still going to be 8 months. It's just whether or not it starts when you sue out the case or you wait 50 days to start that. But the 8 months that you do discovery is the same. It just is when it starts.
I think Mr. Carlson wants to add to this conversation.
Madam Chair and members, Joel Carlson, on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, just to briefly amplify.
Could you speak? Please speak in the microphone.
Sure, Madam Chair. Just to briefly amplify that question, I think to get directly to your point, Senator Sharon, and we had many members who participated on the Civil Justice Task Force at the Supreme Court. I went to many of the meetings myself, and what the streamlining process here that they're trying to get at is to have the parties do the work of agreeing to a discovery plan without having to involve the court in that activity. And so what would happen in the past is if you couldn't agree on a discovery plan, you had to make a motion to the court, you had to compel discovery. Now the parties are expected to work that out among themselves. They just simply didn't cross-reference that ability to make the parties agree on what discovery is available with a statutory requirement to file this expert affidavit. The 180 days remains the same. They're not extending that. We're just taking out that part of the court involvement and having the parties work that out themselves. That was the thrust and the streamlining that the court wanted to accomplish with the rule change. So it's less court involvement in this and more involvement of the parties to get down and get to the merits of the case. Senator Newman pointed out. So that's what the genesis of the rule was.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Carlson, is there anybody opposing this? Is there anybody opposing this?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Madam Chair and Senator Hall. And we've checked as well. So, I mean, no one's come to us, and we've
sure.
tried to search out opposition.
Okay. Any other questions, members?
I love having a bill here without opposition.
Might be the first one.
A new experience. Right, new experience. Okay. We have Chris Messerly, too, that would like to speak on the bill.
I don't think he needs to provide any additional.
I just consulted with Mr. Messerly, unless there are any questions directly he's
okay.
happy to observe today.
All right. Anyone else would
Senator
like to speak?
Sherman, Madam Chair, may I just click? Do you understand?
Senator Lass.
Do you want any further clarification, Senator Sherman? I'm happy to.
There isn't any opposition, and that it's really been searched out for people who might, then I'm comfortable. I'm still, I will still be examining this further. I may talk with you further about it later.
Sure, sure. Well, Madam Chair, I mean, the whole idea is when the state court made their change to try to expedite the judicial process and facilitate the discovery process, Mr. Carlson used the term cross-reference, but really they didn't account for the fact that there is this statute that says you only have 180 days from the commencement of the lawsuit, not from the commencement of discovery. So now the commencement of discovery is delayed, but you haven't delayed
180 days
at all. So all this does is allow for the full 180 days for the expert affidavit to be submitted after discovery has actually started, so that expert affidavit will be based upon full information.
Okay, then I guess, Senator Lass, you want to move your bill, Senate File 2044, as amended?
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 2044 as amended be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Next, we have Senator Lass, Senate File 1997. This is the revisor's bill.
This is excitement. This revisor's bill, that's excitement.
Jeez. Welcome, Ms. Timmons.
Thank you.
And I understand you have an author's amendment, Senator Lass.
Yes.
It's right here.
Chair, we have one of the thickest and least controversial bills of the legislative session in front of us today, and I have a 10-line author's amendment, A14-0809. Should be in the members' packets.
Senator Lass moves A14. What was the rest of it?
A14-0809.
Want to explain the amendment?
Sure. It corrects a couple of subdivision references.
Any questions
references.
On that?
Ms. Timmons can explain the reason.
Any questions on that? Like, what does that mean?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Timmons.
I'm Michelle Timmons, the revisor of statutes. And yesterday, the state auditor emailed us with some suggestions for improvements in the cross-references in this particular section. And it does deal with pensions. So I did ask Mr. Larry Martin, the director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement, who is here today, if you want more detail. I asked Mr. Martin to review this suggestion from the state auditor. He is in agreement with this. The revisor's office is in agreement with this amendment. And we showed a draft to the state auditor staff who are also in agreement.
Is anybody interested in going down the pension road here? No? Okay. Okay. Senator Lass, on your amendment, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. On to the bill.
Madam Chair, this is the annual technical clarifications and corrections bill. There should be no substantive changes in here. It's a matter of getting cross-references and statutory sites and so on accurate. in the case where errors or omissions occurred in previous legislation. Or so that's what we're here for. And this every year, and Ms. Timmons can explain in detail anything you'd like to know about the bill.
Do you want to start with page one, Ms. Timmons? Just kidding. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz, in your reviser bill, do you happen to have any references to a non-refundable $250 fee, as was found in another bill that we had earlier today?
Senator Limmer, I'm not aware of any such reference.
Right. That's all I need to know.
Okay. Trust. It's excellent.
It's your bill.
Okay. And seeing no questions on the revisor's bill, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
I should move the bill.
Oh, I think so. Good idea. Okay. Senator Latz wants to move the bill as amended. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that Senate File 1997 as amendment be recommended to pass and be sent to the Senate floor.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, seeing no opposition, and the bill passes unanimously and is sent to the Senate floor.
Thank you. Madam Chair, just two quick announcements and we can adjourn. We will have committee at noon on Thursday and again at noon on Friday. It's our goal to be done Friday in under 4 hours. We have a lot coming up in the next several weeks. We have decided we don't need to meet this Thursday night, but for subsequent Thursday nights until deadlines, you should anticipate meeting then as well. And trying to not have to meet any other nights during the week, but we may get flooded with re-referrals and from other committees, and as in the past, we'll do everything we can to keep those bills moving, as well as those bills that originate in this committee. I think there are any other announcements to
Senator Limmer?
Yeah. The Thursday night versus a Friday day, is it an either or is it all inclusive?
It's included.
All of the above.
All right.
We do have a short session, but we still have a high volume. And especially for those re-referrals, we know how much other authors want to keep their bills moving and not get it stuck in the pipeline here at Judiciary just because our agenda is pretty full. So we'll do our best to keep those bills moving, too. Subject, of course, to deliberation and approval from this committee.
Once again, I want to say thank you, Ms. Timmons, for the wonderful work of your department. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.